Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Nyman Ranch. I'm Paul Willis, a fifth-generation farmer and co-founder of Nyman Ranch Pork Company. Learn more about us at NymanRanch.com.
Hardcore is a new series from Heritage Radio Network. Over six episodes, we're taking a close look at the rebirth of American cider.
Really, it wasn't until about 10 years ago that cider started to be revitalized in the United States.
From the science of fermentation.
So yeast, it's a fungus, it's a unicellular fungus.
To the magic of terroir.
What really excites us is thinking about communicating that very sort of spiritual aspect of knowing a piece of land.
We're setting aside our cider donuts to gain a deeper understanding of this singular beverage.
I love a cider donut. You don't have to have a cider donut with your cider, and I will die on that point.
Subscribe to Hardcore wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. History being yesterday, or 2 hours ago, or 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. And today we're going to be talking about more recent history. It's about dining out, in large part. And while dining out was really once reserved for the upper class society, it has over the past, and I'm going to say maybe, I was going to say 100 years ago, but I think we can even trim it to 75 years ago. It's become more popular than ever for all classes. No time to cook, the proliferation of affordable options, and the proliferation of restaurants in all price categories. One could say that dining out, whether it's the local cafe or the diner, or the burger joint nearby, or four-star fancy restaurant, or the newest, hippest haunt. It's truly a huge part of American culture. And people are always, if not dependent, curious on the opinions of others. Some people are, of course, tied to the opinions of others and to the reviews that are posted online or in books. And, you know, for centuries, there have been dining guides, and I'm literally centuries, usually upscale, offered for that special dining class. And often they were travel guides or accompanied travel guides. Then along came Zagat in 1979. It broke all molds. You know, it's that narrow little red book that everybody in major cities, at least, and across the world, in international cities too, kept on their desk or on their shelf, ready for reference whenever they were going to go out to dine. The specialty about Zagat and the reason it broke the mold is that it was a guide for the people, by the people. Well, Zagat, Tim and Nina Zagat founded it, and we'll find out more about the history in a minute, in 1979, and then they sold it in 2011, and it has once again been purchased. And it is just now hot off the press, at least the New York City guide as a start. So it's the Zagat 2020 New York City Restaurants. It was acquired by the group called The Infatuation, the website, the team. Infatuation. And joining me today, I have the editor-in-chief of both The Infatuation and Zagat. That she is Hillary Reinsberg, and Hillary joined the company in 2014 as its first employee. She was a writer and editor and did a lot of of writing over the years, wrote for BuzzFeed, wrote stories about all kinds of things, stories about women, politics, culture, tech. And the interesting thing is she really was never a restaurant review writer. And here she is as editor-in-chief of Zagat. Welcome, Hillary.
Thank you so much.
We're going to talk about that. You never were a food writer, as they say, or restaurant review critic. And here you landed a job as editor-in-chief of one of the foremost well-known, trusted restaurant guides in, well, aside from Michelin, probably the world. Whoa, do you consider that a disadvantage that you were never a restaurant critic?
Well, at the time that I came to edit the Zagat Guide, I have been editing restaurant reviews and overseeing our expansion in cities.
For Infatuation.
For Infatuation.
So we're going to lump this together for the time being, okay?
Yeah, so I will say coming to the Zagat Guide, I felt that I actually had quite a lot of experience in thinking about restaurant reviews, especially in New York City, but in cities all over the place. At the Infatuation, we have hired many people to serve as critics who were not traditional critics beforehand. But we're comedians. We have a woman who is our Chicago writer who worked in a hair salon and was the person that everyone called. People would call the salon asking her for restaurant recommendations. So our writers may not have been, and myself included, may not have been traditionally restaurant critics in a past life, but tend to be people who are really passionate about restaurants or really knowledgeable about them. So I would say that I think that the position that I started in was advantageous in that I was passionate about restaurants, but I saw them as a diner, not as an insider. And that's been quite valuable, I think, that perspective. And we try to maintain that perspective of being regular. What is the experience you're going to have as a regular diner?
Well, I think that's a very important feature qualification, actually. And it's part of what Zagat was founded on.
Absolutely.
And that brings me to something that that I wanted to talk about. Why did this group all of a sudden decide to buy? I know a little bit of the story behind it, but buy Zagat. I mean, Zagat had been purchased by Google from Tim and Nina Zagat for a hefty price, and then it sort of. They squandered it. No, it kind of sat on the shelf. I mean, it really, you know, it was around, but it wasn't in prominence. But then again, there is so much competition. There are so many websites, so many online reviews. Everyone's a critic online. I mean, all they have to do is type something up and post it on their website. Why did they decide to resurrect this little skinny red Bible, as they say?
I can really speak to the value that we saw in it, which was it still is an internationally known iconic brand that stands for a lot and really is the gold standard in the Zagat Guide was really the first user generated restaurant resource that existed. Right. They really kind of invented the format. So we had always known the Infatuation is written by critics who, you know, for the most part, it's their full-time job, dine anonymously, and
so it's more of a writer's.
Absolutely. But we knew at the same time that we had built this community of people who felt similarly and were similarly passionate about restaurants. We're not insiders, and we saw them wanting to contribute in some way. It didn't fit onto the infatuation.com's reviews, so it had been something that had been something that was in our minds anyway. And when the opportunity to have Zagat in the house came about, it just felt like such a natural fit. And although they have different perspectives as to where they get the intel for the review, I think the spirit of the brands is really similar. The founding story is even has a lot of parallels. And we saw, as we got to know Tim and Nina Zagat, we even saw those parallels. So the spirit of the two brands, despite being started, you know, 30 years apart, shares a lot of the same DNA.
Well, and this brand, to use Tim Zagat's words, he said, you know, that you have to understand the brand is, you know, it's basically, he didn't say synonymous, but associated with trust, accuracy, and ease of use. Tell me a little bit about, well, and hope this is going to carry on, but let's go back a few steps and talk about that original founding of the Zagat Guide.
Sure. So it's a great story. Tim and Nina Zagat met at Yale Law School and shortly after that went to live in Paris. And they were the young lawyers in their firm. And they became the go-to restaurant people. What were the interesting new restaurants in Paris at the time? And in the 70s, early 70s. And what they created for their, people kept asking them. And what they created was initially something called the Guide des Guides. And they actually aggregated various restaurant guides into one, basically a one sheet of a few pages that was this initial resource. And so they had been in that spirit of creating restaurant guides even before 1979. When they moved back to New York, they were both lawyers. They were passionate about dining. They were at, I believe, a wine dinner. And they had this idea that they said they did. They felt like something was missing. They knew all of these people who were passionate about restaurants, and there were still very few voices that were essentially the newspaper critics that were sort of getting to say what was good. And so they had this idea to circulate a survey among their network, and it was like 120 people, I think, who reviewed 200 restaurants in that first iteration. And from there, the guide was born. And then, you know, that was the Zagat survey, and they started circulating that. And that was 1979. And over the years, it developed, it launched in cities all over the world. You know, in its height, they were doing golf course guides, shopping guides, and it really became this ubiquitous thing. And so many people were contributing that it became this really trusted, easy to use. They were always really they were really thoughtful in a way that we have been similarly with the infatuation about the user first, the reader first. Make this easy for the reader to consume. Make this enjoyable. Make it useful. Make it entertaining. We share those exact values. Shared those values at the infatuation.
That's what I was going to ask you. How important is that brand in your work today with Zagat? And you just said, well, keep it about the user. Right?
Yes, okay. It has to be great to use. It's not for. That's all. That's who it's for. And people wouldn't use it otherwise.
Any of the listeners out there had bought Zagat's from a way back, you know that at a certain point, eventually, you would be sent a survey. And if you filled out X number of restaurants in the survey, you would get a free guide of your city or city of choice. And the surveys were really, I mean, they weren't joking. I mean, they asked serious questions. Can you tell me a little bit about that, about the user reviews and how that works?
So it's now all completely online. It was something that was sent by mail in the early days, but by, I believe, the late 90s or 2000s had become digital. And we used really, you know, we studied the old surveys and the more recent ones that had been circulated in past years and circulated it to the Zagat audience, to the newsletters, to the infatuation audience, and had a tremendous response right away. And people rate the restaurants. They offer comments. They offer, of course, their names are not tied to it, so we're not impacted by who said it. Mm-hmm. But and people also rank their five favorite restaurants, which makes up the most popular list, which is sort of interesting to look in terms of comparing that to the top ratings. And then it comes back to the editors, and we then look through those comments, and that's how we craft the reviews. But it's all those, the quotes, of course, all come from the survey.
Mm-hmm. What if there's a restaurant that you feel in, you're surveying a particular city? Well, right now you're just doing New York City. You just did New York City. Plans to go to other cities, I'm sure. But you're reviewing a city, and there's a restaurant that you feel is, you know, that should be in the book, should have something said about it. But you didn't receive any response about any of them. What happens then? You send another round of reviews, or you send your own people out?
On Zagat, we would not send our own people out to write reviews of places. It really does have to come from the community. It wasn't a problem that we had in this book. We really received an incredibly diverse, broad array of responses. Of course, if a place gets no replies or only one comment, you know, that's not going to be enough. But it really wasn't a problem that we encountered. On the Infatuation, where there's an editorial, you know, everything is made from an editorial first-person perspective. Of course, we would send our writers to places that we think are interesting. But on Zagat, it really is about the diners, and it has to come from the places that the diners are going. And they, with that many people, with, you know, we had 200,000, over 200,000 ratings and reviews, we felt like we covered a lot, quite a lot there.
Yeah,
so it really indeed. Wasn't an issue.
Yeah. Well, as I said before, there's so much competition in restaurant reviewing now, and online particularly. And you've got, you know, TripAdvisor, OpenTable, Eater, and Yelp. And Yelp is probably the only one that even is sort of comparable to the, you know, the user review type thing. And yet it's not controlled like as much as like the Zagat guides are. And a lot of work goes into the Zagat guides into categories. So, which I see a lot of people copy. I get,
yeah.
I think now someone else is starting to do it too. Maybe Resy is starting to compile.
And on
reviews.
The Infatuation, we've, yeah. the whole premise of the Infatuation is built around perfect four categories with the idea that top ratings are valuable. Absolutely. What is a top restaurant? That's tremendously valuable. You should know that the Zagat survey takers thought La Brinadana had the finest food in New York City. But also, you want to know what are, there's a section called Commuter Oasis. So if you're near Penn Station, where do you go? And that's information that's just valuable in your day-to-day life, and you're going to be able to use that year-round. And we've taken the same approach at the Infatuation. Where do you go on, you know, we have a section category.
Date.
First date, exactly. And how is that different from an anniversary date or a second date, you know? And what about a big group dinner, a celebratory dinner? What if it needs to be an affordable dinner because it's a, you know, it's a work event? Or there's all these different situations that people find themselves in and sort of slicing and dicing. Okay, I need this. And it also has to be in the East 50s. And those constraints are kind of what makes it fun, I think. Out of context, it's great to talk about. We love to talk about great restaurants, but providing the context that people can relate to, I think, is kind of the best part.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk a little bit more about how the book is organized in a bit. As far as the history of the book and the guides, how many, do you know offhand how many cities it covered at its peak?
I don't have an exact number, but they were also doing, as I said, golf course guides. They were doing, there was a guide in Tokyo, to Tokyo in Japanese, so really every major city and several regions. They also had several regional guides at the height. They really were everywhere.
Yeah, and internationally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I know we were talking before the show, and I mentioned that back in the day when I used to be at the Food Network, I did a restaurant review show, and you know, we relied heavily on Zagat guides for different cities when we had to add a few restaurants to that city we were going to. And if it weren't for the Zagat guide, you know, it had to take a lot more research. It was kind of like our internet of the day.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, you know, and now you just click the Google button, and you can find, you know, restaurants in whatever city you want, of course. That is an interesting point, and that is the difference between searching online and searching in a book. And do you know what the plans are to keep the book in print or not, or is that too soon to tell?
So the plan with Zagat is we're going to be launching a digital platform next year. So Zagat will continue to be a resource for restaurant discovery, for restaurant guides, for user-generated restaurant discovery. And the book is our first step in kind of relaunching the brand. And, you know, I think I would love to point out that we also brought a lot of the history of Zagat back. We brought it back to 30 points. The reviews look like what people can expect.
Yeah, about the 30 points, because it changed for a while.
Yeah, it was out of 5 points for a while during Google days to be comparable with the way things were there. And people loved the 30 point. We brought that back. We've brought back the old logo. So this is really our first step into our representation of Zagat, our interpretation of Zagat. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to see us doing a lot more in the next year. And I think this is sort of our big kickoff of starting to really do exciting things. So it's I don't think we're quite ready to say exactly where the print, what the future of the book in print is. But we've had tremendous response over the past. It's been selling well, tons of interest. People have been buying custom corporate copy. You know, you, with the, the custom logo copies, we're doing those again. Custom at Zagat.com if you want one. And so we're going to be... listening to the response, listening to people, what people want. And the reason we did this book in the first place was because we knew people would be excited about it. People wanted it. And as I said, it's user first. So we'll be evolving the brand over time, but it certainly will continue to be a place that to be that resource. Exactly, you know, how that happens, I think, will certainly evolve over time. But Zagat is staying in the restaurant review business for sure.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, we're going to talk more about the actual point system and the different categories. But the all-important back of the book organization of the book when we come back after a brief break. So stay tuned.
My name is Paul Willis. I'm a fifth-generation hog farmer, and I owned and operated the Willis Free Range Pig Farm for over 41 years. I've dedicated my life to revitalizing sustainable hog farming methods in the Midwest and moving farms away from the common industrial practices. In 1998, I established the Nyman Ranch Pork Company. I'm proud to say Nyman Ranch has since grown into a network of over 740 independent family farmers and ranchers today. At Nyman Ranch, our animals are raised with care. We believe that the quality of an animal's life impacts the quality of the meat. Our high standards were developed with the help of animal welfare expert, Dr. Temple Grandin, and are among the strictest in the industry. All of our animals live outdoors or in deeply bedded pens, and they're never given antibiotics or added hormones ever, and are only fed a high-quality 100% vegetarian diet. Whether they're raising hogs, cattle, or lamb, Nyman Ranch farmers and ranchers share our commitment to traditional farming. Raising livestock in the way our parents and grandparents did, and supporting our rural communities. We share a common belief that humane and sustainable methods produce the best possible flavor. Learn more about our work at Nyman Ranch at NymanRanch.com.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Hillary Reinsberg, and she is the new editor-in-chief of The Resurrection of Zagat Restaurant Guides. You know, that little red book we talked about. I have to tell you, when the publicist sent me a copy of the book, I put it on the kitchen counter at home, and my husband walked in at the end of the day, and he was, oh my God, a new Zagat guide. Like, where's it been, you know, for all these years? And other people, you know, walked through the kitchen, noticed it, and it generated a lot of excitement just within my own apartment. So I can only imagine what people are thinking when they see this on the newsstands and on the shelves. They will be disappearing.
That is great. I've spent basically my whole career writing online, and so I've never been able to really give people anything. And so being able to show up to dinner and say, I brought you something has been very exciting for me. I've been carrying them around in my bag. Yeah. I've never have enough. Everyone wants one. I'm like, I only brought three.
Well, you put one on the studio's bookshelf, exactly. I see, and I'm just going to see how long it stays there before it disappears and someone, you know, absconds with that. Let's talk about the book. We're going to talk about the new book and how it was designed, and you had a heavy hand in that one. A good heavy hand, not a bad heavy hand. And then we're going to talk about how it was organized from history. So tell me a little bit. You give a lot of history in the beginning of the book, which, of course, is something new because it was always current. So talk about that.
So in addition to being the first book that's been out in a couple of years, it's also the 40th anniversary of Zagat. So we thought, and under new ownership, we thought it was a good moment to basically, for the most part, it be the book that you know and love, open up a random page in the middle, and you see exactly what you'd expect. But we thought it was a good opportunity to take a look back, take a look forward, give some information about the history. Not a crazy amount, but what happened was, as it came about, as we set out to do the book and started working on it a couple months ago, I started doing a lot of research into the old books. And we have a library in our office of all the old books, going, you know, books from the 80s. And we started reading through them, understanding them, reminiscing about old restaurants that had closed. And that provided this inspiration for, we realized, like, there's actually, you can really tell the story of the dining scene in New York City and other cities by looking through these old books. So I put together this retrospective in the front of the book that's decade by decade. And what it does is takes four reviews, historical reviews from old books, republishes them from different years of the decade, and then has some information as well on the decade and a bit of a few paragraphs interpreting that. And it's been, that was really fun to look at how things have changed, what has stayed, what have been the constants, what have been the changes.
And they weren't that many decades, because you really started.
You started
late in the 80s.
Right. Know. Well, the book, the origin was in 1979, right. So that made sense. Yeah, we have, you know, and I think there were a lot of fun throwbacks for people, even whether you were there to experience them or have just heard about them. So we had places like in the 80s, you had La Bernardin opened towards the end of the decade.
They never left the list.
Has never left, stayed strong throughout. You have places like, a lot of people mentioned to me, oh, Florent, which that was a place that people loved in the meatpacking district, that was really iconic, of sort of setting that neighborhood off. Indochine, which was where, you know, it was like a Warhol kind of, you know, Basquiat hung out there, and Madonna, and is still around. And it was a fun look back. And then you have Nobu opening in the 90s, and Blue Ribbon, and... You know, I also threw in some fun ones like Mars 2112, which was this ridiculous theme restaurant,
yeah.
And the fashion cafe we mentioned. So you tried to go high, low, all different types of things. You know, you also have Danielle opened in the 90s. But you see interesting trends happen throughout. One of the things we pointed out was there was a very famous French restaurant, Lutèce, and its sort of rise and fall had been very high in the most popular list, starts to fall through the 90s, then eventually closes. And you see these trends change throughout the years. And then in the 2000s, you have, I think, this big shift towards, you have places like Shake Shack, and the first Momofuku opens, and there's like much more of a trend towards, I think, a lot of the restaurant culture that we have today. You have Roberto's, where we're which we're
sitting
overlooking
in the back
right now, open, but also, you know, and so there's all there. It's a looking back at those old books is just an amazing way to get a read into the New York dining scene,
right,
over the past.
Well, when
years.
I said you didn't start that late, you started in the 80s,
yeah,
because if you're going to look at how the dining scene changed, you didn't go back that far.
Yeah.
But in fact, in just those, well, it's almost 40 years.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
40 years,
right, exactly.
40 year anniversary.
Yeah.
A lot really has changed in the dining industry.
Yes.
I mean, it's, and as I said at the top of the show, I mean, you know, the proliferation of affordable restaurants, it opened up dining to everybody. Mm-hmm. So there's something for everyone.
There really is. And I think you'll find that in this book, although you may see a lot of highly rated fine dining, expensive restaurants,
sure,
there's really a lot of affordable options across all five boroughs.
Well, let's talk about those ratings.
Yes.
It tells you whether it's affordable or not, and how good it is and what it's based on. All right, you said you brought back the 30-point
yes
rating, and now that's what Zagat always had.
Yeah.
And did anyone ever get a 30? And how many?
I don't believe there's ever been a 30. The highest rating in this book is a 29.
And I think 29 was the highest
yes
rating, period. I don't
and,
think anyone
and what's
got a 30.
Interesting, I think, about the book is that you don't have, there is that you have food, decor, and service. And so a restaurant can rank
and
differently.
Cost. Food,
and
decor,
cost, right?
Service, and cost, right?
Right. The cost is, is less of like the that's another data point, but I think it's been right. You see that people, no one sort of wins in every single category.
Right.
Food, decor, service all had different people who different restaurants sort of were the top in that category. And then we also organize all the restaurants by cuisine and by neighborhood. So you're able to see what was the top rated in every category. So you want to know the top rated Korean restaurant or the top rated restaurant.
This is in the back of the book.
In the front, you also have an abbreviated version of top food by cuisine. Right. So we list, okay, what are the top barbecue places? There are three listed in that in the front, or burger joint. And then in the back, you have the extensive, complete directory. Mm-hmm. So you can see every Japanese restaurant listed, and that takes up like a full page.
Well, Danny Meyer wrote the foreword.
He did, yeah.
And he talks about, in the beginning, you said you have, as always were, most popular, top food, key newcomers, international, important international cuisines. And he actually talked about most popular as opposed to top food.
Yeah, he talks about how there's a section in the front called Most Popular, in which survey takers are asked to rate their five favorite restaurants. And that is really a different kind of rating. What is your favorite? It's not always the finest service. And he said that historically he had followed the Zagat Guides coming out, and he tells the story of rushing out from Union Square Cafe to the Union Square Barnes & Noble to pick up his book. And he says that he found that his restaurants were often ranking very high in the most popular, quite well in food decor and service as well, but they were always really winning in that most popular category. And he says that he feels like that represents hospitality.
Yeah.
And a larger overarching sense of hospitality. Which,
yeah, because then you look at the ratings and food was okay, it was okay, it was up there, but it wasn't one of the top ratings. And that, I thought that was very interesting because that is what he became known for.
Absolutely, and I think that, we had our launch event at Echo Mercy Tavern, and he spoke and had continued to echo those sentiments. So,
well, the all overarching important back index of the book, because as you said, it's important. You have to, you're going, you have a meeting at in the Flatiron District, or if you're in some other city by the river, where's a good place to eat? So you have in the back, there's always the listings, and I see they're the same, and that makes me very happy.
Yes.
Cuisines, locations, and special features. Special features we mentioned before, like, where do I go if my parents are visiting? Where do I go on a first date? Where's a great place for a celebration? All right.
Yeah, the categories are a little different, but we have business dining, we have celebrations. Don't believe we have parents, but we have child friendly. Parents is a tough one. It's incredibly subjective, I think.
Yeah.
But dining solo, fine dining, group dining, so jury duty, which is always a fun one.
Now, this is a new one, Old New York Vibe.
Yeah, that's been in past guides under, I believe, a different terminology. Yeah. But
outdoor dining,
exactly.
Music and entertainment. There was always one where to just grab a quick drink or something before.
Yeah, and quiet conversations, romantic places, especially winning wine lists, wine bars, all kinds of things.
But the locations were always very important,
yes,
too, because, in big cities, you're not going to travel, all the way across town just for a quick dinner. If you're, if it's a destination restaurant, yes. And that's always so helpful, especially if you say, okay, we'll meet halfway.
Yeah, exactly.
What's that halfway point?
Yeah. It's really, in L.A., it's all about that in L.A. In New York, people, I think, are a little more willing to travel.
But. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are how many listings? 400?
1,400.
1,400 listings.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a lot of restaurants.
Over 190 restaurant indexes. That's by the cuisine location. So
and
all different categories.
And 200,000 ratings.
Ratings and reviews, yeah.
And reviews. That's pretty good. I think that is a...
57 cuisines.
Yeah.
105 neighborhoods, 5 boroughs.
I think you've got it covered, and I think that this is very exciting, whether it stays in print or it just finds its way in a nice place online in this format. I'm very excited about it, I know, because it was always a very important book to me, and I look forward to reading about all the other cities that come up. Now, The Infatuation, which is the company that bought it, the group that bought it, it will continue to write its own
absolutely
long form, more of a long form type critique or review of a restaurant.
Absolutely. And we think, my opinion on it and our overall take is that there's a great value in both. We don't believe that restaurant review and discovery is a zero-sum game. People want to have different kinds of information, right, and people want to share their own information. That's a huge part of it, the community element. And knowing what an audience has to say and what this writer that you've come to know and follow who's really working on their craft and is entertaining, there's a great place for both of those. I mean, look at the popularity of Rotten Tomatoes or something like that, where you have the critic score and the audience score. That is the way that people consume information. I think there's a wonderful place for both and really no conflict in that.
Yeah, well, I like this for the people, by the people guide.
Absolutely. And the infatuation, the way we write is that too. You know, it's also by the people. It's maybe one person, but they are taking that approach of thinking for the audience, not for just the insider or person who knows everything already.
Yeah. Will you be giving voice to any particular writers eventually, you think?
In
the infatuation. Not, certainly not Sagat.
We have full-time staff writers in cities across the country and in London. So we have writers in Chicago and we just hired an editor in Texas who's going to be hiring writers in Austin, Houston, and Dallas. We have a handful of writers in LA and in New York, and their names are all on their pieces, and they all have their own followings and stories to tell. So we are hiring more of them,
hiring
in Texas, in Washington, D.C., hiring in Miami, where we just launched, and looking for more writers there. So pretty much all the cities, we're looking for great people. And again, they don't have to have previously been food writers. They need to be people who are passionate about restaurants and are strong writers and funny people. And that
is theinfatuation.com.
That is theinfatuation.com.
Theinfatuation.com. Okay. And certainly Zagat.com. Has an online presence now?
It does. And we'll be evolving that in a lot of ways over the next year.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Well, it's very exciting. And
thank
I
you.
Wish
We're
you
excited too.
All the luck. And
thank you.
We could launch into a whole history of restaurant review critics, and that would take us back to the or late 17... Restaurants weren't around in America. You'd have to go back to France.
Right.
Because there were no restaurants in America, but certainly the 1800s. And that would be fun, too. But none stands out like Sagat. Thank you.
Thank
Hillary
you so much.
Hillary Reinsberg, editor-in-chief of Zagat. And thank you for listening. Again, this has been A Taste of the Past. A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.